Hi, I'm Jeremy Leslie, and this is the Mag Culture Podcast. I'm here at the Mag Culture Shop, where I'm ready to dive into an illustration-orientated 39th episode of our podcast with guests Kathy Omadilis, the founder of Anorak, the happy mag for kids, and Charles Baker, editor of The Fence, which styles itself the UK's only magazine, a transparently untrue statement. Before we meet those guests, a little Mag Culture news. It's over 4 months now since our last podcast, which gives a sense of how busy the start of the year has been here. Busy with what, you ask? Well, for a start, events. We've welcomed Natasa Papa from Desired Landscapes and Francois and Sasha from Review Fair to the shop for talks. We also had a great evening dedicated to queer zines. All of these are available on the Mag Culture Vimeo page if you missed them first time around. We also ran another successful flat plan masterclass with 50 wannabe publishers joining us online for 2 days of talk and advice. Now, this being our first podcast of the year, I thought we'd take a look ahead of what's coming events-wise across 2024. Coming up here soon is Off Print London, a free festival of print at Tate Modern from the 17th to 19th of May. That's followed quickly by the DNAD Festival, also on the South Bank, from the 21st to 22nd of May. We'll be there. Our pop-up shop will be on site, as usual, with the DNAD Festival. Then jumping to later in the year, there's IndieCon in Hamburg from the 6th to 8th of September, always a great coming together of the independent magazine scene. And that's closely followed this year by Mag to Mag in Italy, in Milan, run by local shop Frabs. And I'll be speaking there. That runs from 14th to 15th of September. Plus, of course, there is Mag Culture Live, which will be taking place in London in November. And we're just now completing plans for the New York edition. So listen out for news of that very soon. It's due early summer. Other than that, it's just been very busy in the shop itself. So many great new magazines arriving and more customers than ever coming by to check them out. So let's take a look at some of those new magazines. And here I bring in Kathy, our first guest from Anorak, to share a few thoughts on what she spotted on our shelves. Kathy, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for having me.
It's lovely to catch up with you after all this time. We'll come to that in a sec. But first of all, as I said in the intro, this is kind of a bit of an illustration-themed issue with you and the work on Anorak and then The Fence coming up later. You had a quick look at the shelves and what did you find? What was your impression?
So this year we're celebrating our 18th anniversary and this is... I haven't come to the shop in a long time, but it's a really nice surprise to see so many magazines have flourished and so many magazines have come through. You know, when we launched 18 years ago, using illustration in a magazine fully was kind of a bit of a pioneering thing. I think, of course, some magazines were doing it, but fundamentally, magazines were mostly carry photography. And now to see that actually illustration is used, you know, fully in most of the magazines is absolutely amazing. So illustration makes me really happy. Uh-huh. So I'm very happy to be here surrounded by, you know, lots of beautifully illustrated magazines.
I pulled a few examples of exactly that from the shelves. And I think... what's interesting to me is the range of magazines that are using illustration. So, for instance, we've got here, it's actually the New York Review of Architecture, but this is a special issue about Los Angeles. So, usefully and slightly irritatingly, retitled their magazines the Los Angeles Review of Architecture, which is very confusing. But nonetheless, every issue of this, although it's you know, it's a very serious architectural magazine with lots of essays, etc., but the covers always feature these brilliant illustrations of groups of rats.
Wow.
In buildings.
Yes. This is so cool and it's so incredible. This is why I love illustration so much, because it just leaves space for so much imagination. Mm-hmm. And it's super grabbing. And I hadn't even noticed the rats, if I'm honest. I've just had a look at it. But that's incredible. And it just shows how much of a range you can get with illustration, which is why I set up Anorak to be fully illustrated mm-hmm. in the first place, because it leaves that space for imagination and for doing things that are just much more eye-grabbing than a photography might be. There's more you can do with it.
Imagination is the key thing, isn't it? Because an architecture magazine with hand-drawn rats running around buildings, I mean, the only way you can have that is to draw it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Or the photography shoot will be very expensive, or it'll be a CGI thing. But yes, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting that they just... they just have this space for imagination because often magazines used to come from a very rigid kind of template. And I feel like people breaking out of those templates of, like, you know, the three columns, the cover that has to have a person so that you have eye contact, and all of that has kind of gone away a little bit, which I really love. I think it also probably stems from the fact that you don't rely so much on shops maybe any longer. Saying that in a shop, but you know, you don't, you know, the big shops, I mean, like the big kind of chains like the WH Smith of this world have very strict rules in terms of, like, these kinds of magazines sell if you have a person on the cover, if you have eye contact, and all these kind of rules have sort of disappeared. So I feel like there's a lot more freedom now and a lot more exploration, which is incredible. I love it.
But it's interesting what you say in terms of templates and the rules and stuff, because another magazine launched, it was after Anorak, but
not so far after it.
So it's part of the same generation in my mind anyway. It is Little White Lies, the movie magazine.
Yeah.
And I've just pulled, we've got that here because that has always been illustration orientated. And the history, the story behind that was always that, you know, as a startup, they couldn't afford the big kind of movie star images that you would expect to see on a front cover. So they just started illustrating, and it was a kind of, it was a brave decision, but it was a decision of necessity to move to illustration.
Yeah.
And they've kept doing it. And this is issue 102.
Wow.
And each one features a movie. And in this case, it's Zendaya in the tennis movie challenges. It's been a fantastic series of 102 covers, purely illustrated.
Yeah. This just makes me super happy. It's just, I'm so glad to see that they're still around, first of all. And I'm so glad that they've just broke that mold from, like, you know, the typical kind of film magazines, which had the superstar on the cover, and that they'd show that illustration can just, you know, give you another template, another way of exploring things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beauty of us being independent. We can do that. We can afford to do these, to make what people, you know, the mainstream market might consider as mistakes, or as experiments, at least. We can afford to do that, which is amazing. So I'm super happy to see that they carry on with that formula, because it's great.
And then I do just want to share this magazine from the Netherlands, Wobby, which is it's risograph printed, but it is pure illustration on a theme.
Oh my gosh, it's absolutely stunning. I love the cover. I love the illustration style. What is it about?
Each one's theme. This one's about courting.
Wow. I mean, the illustrations are absolutely beautiful, and that's really the sort of thing that I would absolutely want to read and go further. And the fact that they're using Riso as well is just beautiful, absolutely stunning. And it just goes back to this thing about magazines being, you know, objects and things that you want to keep and things that you want to cherish. And they are little, this is an object of art for me. This is something that, you know, I will keep forever, just like I would keep a book forever that I like. So I love this.
And moving Wobby out from the pile, we come to Anorak.
Yes.
And we should dig a bit deeper into that. Now, we were talking before we started actually recording this. The last time we spoke in depth about your magazine was in 2015. And that was a live event that led to my book, Independence. And at the time, Anorak was 9 years old, and now it's another 9 years on, so 18. So it's time we had another chat. And you have reached, the magazine has reached its majority, is a phrase that came to mind. But how's it going?
It's going super well, thank you. It's been obviously a roller coaster the last kind of 18 years, but at the moment we're doing incredibly well. I feel really blessed that I've been able to keep this going. We, the sales are going great. Dot is still going as well, but Dot is 6 years old, so it's the baby brother or sister. And we've just agreed to a Chinese distribution deal, so a whole new market is opening up for us.
Will that be translated?
That will be in English for now, and then there's talks about possibly translating it later, but for now it's an English distribution deal. And which opens up, you know, volume, which is great. Yeah. And then we also have a Korean edition, which has been going for the last kind of 2 years, which is doing really, really well too. My big thing with Anorak was always because it's so crafted, I was never sure whether it could be really fully translated because we do a lot of things with hand-drawn type and it's quite anarchic in a way, the way it looks. but it is doable uh-huh. because we've just proved it with the Korean market, and it's doing really, really well. So
and that one's translated.
Chuffed. That is absolutely translated. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it looks really stunning. They've uh-huh. done an amazing job with it, including the hand-drawn fonts and everything. So yeah, it's going super well.
Cool, good. And going back to the kind of origin story, which we know, but maybe the listeners don't know so well, in part the magazine was launched because you felt there was something lacking in the children's market when your son was that age. He was four or five. And now obviously he's grown up. And has that changed how the magazine works now? People that make magazines talk a lot about having an audience in mind. And I guess when you began, that audience was effectively your son. Who is your audience now? Who do you think of when you're making a magazine?
So this is a great question. Thank you so much for asking it, because really, there's been an evolution with Anorak, of course. And when I first launched it, I launched it fundamentally because I wanted a magazine that I could share with my son. You know, we used to go to supermarkets and look at magazines, and it was just basically Batman Weekly with lots of plastic toys on the cover, or it was Football Monthly, whatever it was, you know, and these magazines would just last about 2 seconds, and then he wasn't interested anymore. So I thought I wanted to launch something that was a bit more substantial. And the very first issues are very much about the relationship that I had with, we used to go traveling, we used to do cultural things, and all of that fed into the magazine. And I loved magazines myself because back towards the end of the 90s and the beginning of 2000s, I used to work for The Face and Sleaze Nation as a publishing director and on the advertising side as well. And I always had the bug for magazines, for sure. And I was looking for the magazine that I would love to launch. And I didn't want to launch something that was already there. I couldn't find really what would it be. And it's when I had O, my son, that I just realized, okay, yes, the kids' magazine market is looking very samey. It's looking very throwaway. And I remember magazines that I used to read when I was a child, and they were substantial. They were magazines that I kept. They were annuals, you know, from like the sort of 80s and stuff. So I wanted to replicate that. But obviously, my son has grown.
Yeah, yeah.
So have I. And, you know, at one point it was like, why am I doing this for? You know, when he reached kind of his teenage years, his sort of 10 years, 12 years, 14 years old, I had a bit of an existentialist crisis. I was like, why am I doing this magazine now? And I realized that actually I wasn't really doing just for him. I was also doing it for myself. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And I was basically writing for, you know, the child within. And I remember specifically, I decided instead of bringing out 4 editions a year, I only brought out 2. It was a little test to myself to think what would happen if I stopped Anorak. And I just realized how much I missed it. And actually, it was more than just, you know, my relationship with my son. It was about, you know, basically my creativity. It was my creative outlet. And also we had established a readership, which was there. And I just kept getting so much great feedback. I was like, I can't just let it go. I can't just, you know, mm-hmm. this child cannot go. It will have to stay with me for the next 18 years. The human child can go. The paper kids have to stay with me.
Yeah. Cool.
So it was a real shift in terms of perspective, and also reason why I launched a magazine. But it became, you know, something even better in a sense. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it wasn't just about my relationship with my son. It was fundamentally, you know, about me, but also about the audience that we'd created and the uh-huh. community that we'd created around it.
Talking to publishers about their magazines and such, and so many struggle to make their projects pay, frankly. I mean, and to be fair, many of them, that's not the point, you know. But in your case, it's always been... a primary activity. It's been what you've been doing for the last 18 years. Has it always made money?
So no, but it's never lost mm-hmm. that much. Mm-hmm. So right at the beginning, it lost quite a bit because I had literally no idea what I was doing. You know, the magazine, I think the very first editions were £3.50, and I was spending a huge amount on an art director, on illustrators, on printing a small amount as well. Mm-hmm. So I definitely know back then I didn't make any money whatsoever. But I very quickly started to think, you know, I can't just keep this going because I don't have money. I don't come from a privileged background. So it was literally like, this has to work. So for me, it's always been about if it breaks even, it's okay. If it makes money, we're happy. And it's always done that. Mm-hmm. It's always covered for every cost, which is amazing. And then at times, you know, in certain years, it just does extremely well. So at the moment, we're doing very well. We're very blessed to be doing super well. But it did extremely well during the lockdowns as well. And then there has been some fallow years. Absolutely. It's very hard to keep that going. But, you know, provided it doesn't lose any money, I'm just happy. Mm-hmm. It's fine.
Which is refreshing to hear, because I think so many startups and businesses and things that you hear about, it's all about getting bigger. This desire for rapacious growth, just, you know,
yes.
next target.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because actually I fell into that trap, and it is an absolute trap. I fell into that trap maybe 3 years into it, mm-hmm. and where I was chasing numbers. I was looking at other mainstream magazines, and I was like, oh my God, they're selling 30,000 a week. I'm selling 4,000 or 5,000, you know, a quarter. How can I compare myself? How can I get to their level? And actually I realized that I was just so obsessed with the chasing of numbers that I was taking the joy out of making the magazine. And of course, like, as I said, I don't come from a privileged background. I have to make the numbers work because it's a business, it's my livelihood. But I figured there's got to be a way where I can keep it going without really obsessing too much. And provided, as I said, if it breaks even, it's fine. So I got a job on the side, and that's how, you know, I managed to kind of keep going myself, have a, you know, whatever lifestyle in London that I have, but also being able to keep the magazine going. I think often the thing that I learned right at the beginning was, like, sometimes you just want something to work so much, you put literally everything into it, and that's when it's most likely to fail. I mean, sometimes it works, you know, some people are lucky, they have healthy bank accounts and they have money on the side, or whatever it is, you know, they have those things and they can keep them going. But for me, I didn't. And sometimes you find yourself, you put way too much into it, when really take the pressure off it, get yourself a normal job or another job, and then that takes the pressure off financially of this product not being able to survive. Mm-hmm. So it's not like life or death any longer.
I think the key phrase for me in that you said was keeping the joy in it.
Yes. So that's really important, because I wasn't ready to let it go just for the sake of the fact that it might not have been making a lot of money. And this is a really... everything is based on joy with Anorak. You know, I absolutely love doing it. I get a lot of pleasure out of, you know, commissioning, writing, doing all of this. So for me, it's massively important that we keep it going, regardless of the business model.
When you first started, you were commissioning illustration. I mean, you said you had an art director, but largely you were doing everything. Is that still the case now? I mean, you're still very hands-on.
Yes, because that's what I love doing. Mm-hmm. As I said, you know, I lost myself in the business side for like 3 or 4 years. I was obsessed with that and I was getting no joy out of it. So for me, it was like I made a map of all the stuff that I was doing for the magazines and the areas that I was concentrating on. And I just realized there was whole other areas that I wasn't concentrating on that were the sources of joy. Mm-hmm. And those areas was art directing, commissioning, writing, coming up with concepts, speaking to our little fans, and all of that stuff is what I love doing. So therefore, that's what I will do.
Okay.
The social media, the business side, I can get people to help me to do this.
Well, that was my question. So perhaps instead of having help on the art direction or the creative side,
yeah.
you focus on that and you bring in somebody to run the accounts or do whatever the dry business side is.
Yeah. I mean, I say that, but I still run a lot of our social media channels. It depends on kind of, you know, it depends on the time of the year.
But you have some support now.
I have some support, whereas before I didn't. I have an accountant, I have a bookkeeper, I have a web guy, I have, you know, social media, I have an amazing PR girl. So, you know, all of that is looked after by other people.
All of whom receive some payment for what they... I mean,
100%.
Yeah. I just want to clarify that, because for some people might be thinking that they're friends or favours.
No, not anymore. Not an 18-year-old magazine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely not. Everybody gets paid, and including the, you know, the illustrators and everything else. And that it was from the start. I've never pulled favours. I don't really get the concept of free internship or anything like that. I don't think it's fair. So for me, it's like everyone gets paid, mm-hmm. for sure.
Good. I mentioned my book Independence, which featured Anorak and yourself. That had 12 interviews in it. One of them was with Steve from Stack, so that's not a magazine. So there were 11 magazines. 7 of those are no longer published. So this is going back like 9-10 years now. But the four that still exist are Anorak, Delayed Gratification, I Magazine, and Rap. What do you think it is about Anorak that has meant it survived and others didn't? The other magazines all had their successes and for various reasons failed to survive. But what do you think it is about Anorak that's ensured its 18 years?
I mean, this is incredible, isn't it? When you gave me that fact, I was just like, wow, this is a real sobering thought, because it's only like 9 years ago that 11 magazines existed and now just only four have managed to survive. So it's kind of sad in a way, but also it made me even proud about what we've achieved, because we've managed somehow to pull through the ranks. I think the reasons are several. From a business perspective, as I said, I've always managed to find a way to make it work. And fundamentally, I built the business through social media, and my business is 90% of online sales. So I sell to shops, of course, like yours, but not that much. Fundamentally, all of our sales come from online, because I was very quick to jump into the social media platforms, and I developed a community and I developed a reach through that. I feel like people often think that magazines are like overnight successes, but they're not. Magazine publishing is a long game, and you need to be so patient with it. Building up a whole community around it takes ages. We live in a world of kind of instant gratification, where people think things have to happen overnight, and often people give up too early. And I'm very stubborn and I'm very resilient. So I would, if I had given up Anorak like 2-3 years into it because it wasn't really making money, imagine the shame of that. You know, a lot of kids would have, you know, missed out on that. But also me, I would have missed out on all the fun and learning through the mistakes that we've made from a business perspective. I think creatively what has made Anorak survive and thrive is because it's very unique. Of course, there are other magazines that have moved into that niche in the last 18 years. Some have stayed, others have gone. But Anorak is still fundamentally very unique creatively. The tone of voice is different. Every time you open a magazine, you have no idea what you're going to get, because I have no idea what I'm going to write about until I do it. So there's that absolutely uniqueness that I think has made Anorak something that people just keep coming back to. And the audience keeps getting renewed, because I have a very small window, of course.
I want to ask about this, because in one sense, I mean, and you would never do this, but in theory, you could just have, what's the window, about 4 years of?
Yes, between six and ten, yes.
So, there is the potential for just producing 4 years worth of magazines and repeating them. And I'm not suggesting you would ever do that. But that window is very specific. So it's sometimes people talk about magazines growing up with their readership or developing with their readership, keeping up with it, et cetera. But in your case, it's a continual churn, right?
Yes, basically every 4 years we get a new readership.
The complicating factor being that it's not like one cohort of kids that grow out, and it's not like every 4 years they're replaced. It's like every day.
Exactly.
Every month, every issue they're being replaced by. Someone grows out of it, so another kid comes into it.
Yeah. This is interesting, because you've made me realise that actually not only we don't produce, you know, the same content, but also I've never repeated a theme. Every single issue has a theme.
Yeah.
And for the last 18 years, all the themes have been different because I have such a huge respect for our audience. And for me, it would be crazy if I started renewing content. It would feel like I'm cheating them in a sense. And I know this comes maybe from a perfectionist point of view, which is from a business point of view, doesn't make much sense. But for me, it's really important that every single magazine is a very unique experience and it doesn't get repeated. We get bombarded, children get bombarded all the time with the same kind of experiences. Let's not forget, I launched Anorak because the rest of the market just looked the same. It's this sea of pink and blue magazines. So So if I'm going to be, you know, true to ourselves, why would I do the same? Why would I be formulaic when, you know, this is exactly what I'm against? And it's hard from a business perspective because you not only you change, you have to educate people. This is a new kind of magazine. This is not the kind of magazine you throw away after a week. It has a different kind of humor in it. It has different type of educational pieces in it. But it is, that's why it's, that's its worth, that's its value. And for me, that's so important that I don't cheat my audience.
Sure. I think the other unique aspect, of course, is that it's, the content is all timeless. I mean, largely, the themes are timeless. The current one is the reading issue. You did the ice cream issue, sports, football. I mean, what other issues? Just give us a flavour of...
Oh, my God, there's been 67. So this is a real test, is a quiz.
Starting with number one.
Oh, my God, it was space. Because launch, right? I thought it was a little kind of funny thing about that. But we've had all sorts of themes. And the themes are very different from the kind of themes you might get also into the mainstream market. So we've had themes that are a bit more abstract and philosophical, if you could say that, which are like fear. We've had kindness and that sort of thing. We've also had themes on ice cream, because I'm completely crazy about ice creams, sweets. We had cakes editions. We've had reading editions. We've had football editions, because I'm also mad about football. And we've had dragons. The only themes we will never have are robots, princesses, and dinosaurs, because the mainstream market is literally filled with that. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels like that's the only thing children are interested in. If you go to any bookshop or any magazine shop, you will see it's always about that. And I'm just like, no, children are interested in everything. They're literally sponges. So let's feed them stuff that's really going to expand their minds.
And after 67 issues, do you worry that you're running out of themes?
Absolutely not. I will never run out of themes. Mm-hmm. I have a bank of about 12 already for the next few years. So we're all good. There's so many things interesting in life that I think we can feed and pass on to children beyond robots.
As we said, so I mean, 18 years is a good long time in publishing, and we've talked about how the magazine has developed to some degree, but I'd like to turn to the actual illustration itself, which you've already spoken very eloquently about the power and the importance and the excitement you still have for illustration as a form and to see it in publishing. But how have you seen illustration change over those years? Has it changed?
I don't think it's changed. I think it's become more competitive, so I have more choice, which is amazing from a publisher and an art director point of view. It's less amazing from an illustrator point of view, because obviously the market is much more competitive. I think we really, I didn't realize at the time how much we were breaking this mold. When we were, a lot of the times the illustrators that we were commissioning right at the beginning had never done any illustration for children, for the children's world, publishing world. They mostly had done it for, you know, comics or things like that, but it was never aimed at kids. So I think earlier I was saying, you know, I was joking a little bit about how pioneering we were, and it's you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, I finally realized that we were pioneers, because right at the beginning, a lot of the illustrators that we were using never did anything for children. And to me, it sounded weird, because the way the illustration style was is very similar to how a child would illustrate or would draw. So for me, there's beauty in that. So now there is a lot more choice. But in terms of the way we commission illustrators, it's exactly the same way as we've done a few years back. So nothing has changed in that area.
In terms of the illustrators you work with, do you keep a sort of a range of people that you regularly work with and then every now and again bring someone else new in? Or are you always looking for new people?
So commissioning illustration has changed in the last 18 years, because originally we had a lot less choice. And obviously the social media platforms didn't exist that much. They weren't that, well, they existed. Instagram was around, but it wasn't as developed as it is now. So before, it was literally like people we knew, universities. I did a lot of talks and lectures at universities, which I still do now. But now fundamentally we have, illustrators have become self-promoters as well. So they use those channels, social media channels, to promote themselves. And fundamentally the way I commission them, the way I find them is through social media. So Instagram is my main kind of port of call. but also because of who we are and because we've kickstarted a lot of careers for illustrators. A lot of very mainstream illustrators now started with us, which is a huge source of pride for me. They know us. So I tend to receive like 2 or 3 portfolios a week, even though on our website, I'm like, no, no submissions, please, because we just, I don't have the time to go through every portfolio, but I meet a lot of them at universities doing lectures. I've just come back from the Bologna Children's Book Fair, where I did portfolio reviews.
That's
there.
An extraordinary event, isn't it?
It's an amazing event. We need a magazine event just like that. Mm-hmm. Jeremy, get well, just like
it's,
that.
It's not, well, I mentioned in my introduction, IndieCon that happens in Hamburg. That's a lot smaller. I mean, I've been to Bologna and it is the most extraordinary, I don't know what it is, it's kind of industrial scale show of children's products, books.
Yes, yes. And I was really shocked because I didn't expect that scale because, you know, Bologna is a nice little cute town. So in my head, I was like, oh, it's going to be a nice few gathering of people. And it's literally 3-4 hangars of just in the every single children's books publisher is there. Every single illustrator is there. And it's really overwhelming, but it's really exciting as well because you just see how much there is around. And, you know, I've come back with literally a suitcase filled with new illustrators, new contacts, it's just an amazing place. So we need that kind of stuff that supports and promotes magazines in the UK.
Well, we try. So there's that, there's Instagram. And then when you're actually working with them, you've got a theme. If we look at the current issue, reading. I have to admit, I first thought it was the Reading issue, which is a completely different theme.
But it's English the reading for you, issue. The English language,
You've got the theme reading. You presumably are coming up with a bunch of different angles on that. Mm-hmm. You work with various people. You work with your little editors.
Yes, correct.
And at that stage, having decided on doing reading, do you then talk to them about what they want to know about reading or what they expect to hear about reading?
So the way we commission illustrators is, for example, with this edition, it's very simple. I have the themes worked out a year in advance and I will have already in mind what the feature will be like and therefore what the guest illustrator will be. So we have a guest illustrator that will do the cover and the main feature. I will write these. I will do really terrible sketches because I'm really crap at drawing. But I will do really rough sketches. I will send that to them and we will put that together.
So you get quite specific in terms of...
Yeah, I get specific. It depends on the illustrator. Some illustrators want to be, you know, they want to see a sketch and they want to know exactly what needs to go on the cover. Others are a little bit more free-flowing and they want to explore and experiment, which I'm happy for them to do.
Or perhaps you've already got a working relationship with someone and so it's...
We don't have a huge roster of people that we use over and over again. The reason for that is because every single magazine that I have, for me, has to be a surprise and I would never want it to be like the Anorak Club and there's a club that you can't get in. You know what I mean? Like, I just want to use as many illustrators as possible because there's so many incredible ones out there, but also because for my readership, I want to expose them to as many different styles of illustrations as possible. Then there are the regular sections that are done by Ben Javens, who's our main designer and illustrator. And then there are the stories. So I write every story. And while I write those stories, I visualize the style. Mm-hmm. And then I will think, okay, who would be good for that? And I look at either my black book of illustrators, you know, portfolios, or I'll just go and on Instagram and just have a little look and explore.
And presumably you're also thinking about, well, we've already got this illustrator and that illustrator. We need something a bit more hand-drawn or a bit more colourful or a bit more... Do you sort of think like that?
Yeah, so this is interesting because everything that I do from an art direction point of view, because I was never trained, I didn't go to uni and did a graphic design degree or whatever it is, everything that I do is purely instinctive. So I don't even ask myself those questions. They just happen. Mm-hmm. There are some times where we've had, you know, an illustrator coming back with a cover that has the same kind of color palette of a previous edition that we've just done. And then I'll be like, okay, this is the color palette that we need to use. Mm-hmm. Let's not use the same one. But I don't even think about the, you know, the ins and outs of like, oh, I must have a hand-drawn one this time or whatever. I don't. It's completely purely instinctive. And it just works, which is, it surprises me. Every single edition, it surprises me because I'm like, surely there's got to be some secret behind this. Yeah. But it's not. It's purely instinctive and it works.
What size is your readership now?
We sell 12,000 editions per edition, and that just includes... And actually, our US market is the biggest market now. So we sell more in the US than we sell in the UK, which is incredible because they're spending a lot of money on postage. So the magazine...
And they all come from the UK?
All come from the UK. They're shipped there. You know, if anyone out there has a great distribution network in the US, I would be more than happy to speak to them. We sell to shops in the US through a distributor called Small Changes, which are amazing. But that's a fairly new relationship. But otherwise, our readers will just get it from our shop, which means they're, you know, an issue, a single issue is about $20, which is, to me, is mind-blowing. But it just shows that.
And you say readers, presumably most of the people doing the buying are actually parents or relatives or friends.
Parents and grandparents buy the magazines, and this basically anything that we do from a promotional point of view, whether it is, you know, through our newsletter or our website or our social channels, is always aimed at parents. Not aimed at children. So our audience is made of 70% of parents and families and grandparents who buy them for their children and grandchildren. But the other 30% is fundamentally grown-ups who love the magazine because it reminds them of their childhood, or they might be illustrators, or they might be in the industry and they just want to see what we're up to. Or, you know, that kind of stuff. So we've got 70-30% split.
And what feedback do you get from people?
Amazing feedback. And this is why I love running a magazine. I don't have a team of 75 people who, you know, stop me from having that direct interaction with our audience. I just love receiving those emails from from parents, from children. I received one just a couple of days ago. A mum was asking where the next issue was, and then she sent me a note, a PS, which was this long, rambling, really amazing note about how she loved the magazine, the fact that, you know, she buys other magazines for her children, but within 2 minutes they go in the bin, and Anorak has been passed on from one child to another, and then she gives them away at her school, you know, to children once they've been used and reused. So for me, that's really important, that this is why I launched it in the first place, that it had that staying power. And I think, you know, you find editions now on eBay editions for $30 to $100. So that's super important because I just don't want to, you know, fill more landfills, basically.
But then there's the kind of the million-dollar question. In a smartphone world, do kids still want to read mags?
100%. If you give them an alternative, they will absolutely want to read it. You know, this idea, I know the stats are telling you children read less, but the children's books market is one of the most thriving market at the moment. And I don't compete really with magazines as such. I compete more with books. The purchase that a parent would make towards Anorak is the same pattern as they will make towards a book because we, you know, you can keep the magazine, it's got a higher price point. So that market is really thriving. Children are reading books. Parents are giving children books because everyone is aware on how screen culture is, you know, making us depressed. It's making us feel disconnected. And Anorak is used definitely by parents as the alternative to this screen culture, the place where children can immerse themselves, have some quiet times, go back to a pen and pencil, draw, expand their imagination, expand their creativity, and parents give us that feedback all the time, which is brilliant. And you know, when I launched it, this wasn't even in my brain. I was launching it because I wanted an alternative to the crappy mags out there. But now it has a different mission. It has almost like a different level in that mission, which is we are the alternative to screen culture. We're not the only alternative, obviously, because there are books and things like that. But we are one of the alternatives for screen culture, so it's great.
But it's a really interesting dilemma, isn't it? On the one hand, you know, from your audience's point of view, the children, you want them to be perhaps, well, certainly diverse away from screens the whole time. But I mean, yet, you, as discussed, your business, our business at MagCulture, are reliant on digital formats and channels like Instagram. You post a lot of stuff online, and one regular theme is ice cream. We mentioned ice cream earlier, but... where can I get the best pistachio ice cream?
Oh, my gosh. You're putting me on the spot. Okay, so the best pistachio ice cream you can get in London is a Lebanese ice cream, and you will get it from Festoc, which is in St. Christopher's Place. And the way Lebanese ice creams work is they have a product in them called mastic, which is a kind of elastic kind of thing, ingredient. And they fundamentally use that in their ice cream, which means they're slightly elastic and they are absolutely delicious. But also what they do is they crush pistachios and then just put pistachios all around the cone of the ice cream. And I'm telling you, it's the best.
I'm heading there. I'm also going to order a copy of the ice cream issue of Anorak.
I think I can give you one for free, Jeremy. I think you'll be fine.
Kathy, great to catch up with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
London Printers Park Communications play a key part in the independent magazine scene, producing some of the biggest titles while also helping new publishers turn their dreams into reality. They've recently printed issues of Mag Culture regulars Beauty Papers, Designio and Noble Rot, as well as new design review Anima. And we're excited to see the new issue of Mother Tongue they've just finished. As well as high creative standards, Park are also committed to producing your magazine in the most environmentally friendly and sustainable manner. Download a free copy of their sustainable print guide from the Park website. Search Park Communications. Just like Mag Culture, Park love magazines, and we're proud to have them sponsor the Mag Culture podcast. Another magazine that relies on illustration is The Fence, the London magazine based on an enjoyably scurrilous and very English mix of humour, investigation and politics. I spoke to editor Charles Baker just as its 19th issue hits shops. Thanks for joining me, Charles.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It's lovely to be here.
The Fence magazine describes itself on its cover as the UK's only magazine, which sets its character well. And if you know it, it makes absolute sense. It's a cheeky kind of tagline to have. But what should a first-time reader expect from its pages?
You should expect 64 pages of investigations, features, dispatches, comic slices, maps and diagrams on matters trivial and on subjects very important. And it's all illustrated with a playful touch. And this issue is particularly focused on life in London, but our remit is usually within the whole of the UK and Ireland as well.
Mm-hmm. It does, in a sense, I mean, what you described, it has quite a traditional format, if you like. Even going all the way back to the kind of the pamphlets of 18th century London, it's a mixture of the gossip and then really more significant serious stories.
Yes. Well, I always wanted it to mirror the type of fantastic conversation of an evening that you might have in with great friends and new friends and old friends in a pub or at dinner, where the conversation ranges around all matter of topics and there's lots of laughter and also matters of moments of quiet reflection. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, in that respect, I suppose it does sort of hark back to the 18th century coffee houses and Steele and Addison and all of those pamphleteers, which I think is when magazines really started in this country.
Can you give us a couple of examples from the new issue? Issue 19 is just
this
landed.
This is issue 19, yeah.
Gives an idea of that scope.
Sure. So, I mean, in regards to gossip, we've got this. One of our opening pieces called Bread and Circuses, in which we've asked everyone in different sectors of the London world what their office parties are like, from publishing, media, politics, medicine. And we've rated them in terms of horniness, drug use, level of conversation, and we've got that's a sort of fun opener, which I feel that most people will be keen to read.
What's the best place to be at a party then?
I think
the best party to be at.
I think the food world parties, I think, are pretty decent. The worst ones, I mean, the worst ones are the tech parties.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was that. I mean, you don't really want to be at many of them, to be honest. I think it was the general consensus. And very interesting, the thing I found really interesting about it, because we started out as quite a sort of silly piece, is that in the financial world, they don't really have office parties anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe in the very small companies they do, but at the big banks, they don't. It's now completely banned.
They don't indulge.
Well, they're making too much money. So
I like the fact that you end it with journalism. And the simple statement, most of these areas from finance, foodies, music, politics, TV, film, etc., medicine, have quite long paragraphs of description. But journalism, it just simply says, nobody works in journalism, and especially for a magazine, has ever been to a shit party for professional reasons.
Yes, well, we thought we'd just say nothing on the subject.
Yeah, yeah. so that's one part of it. That's very, yeah. One, but very important part of it. It's sort of that. It's a very English sense of humour.
Yeah.
So give us an example of the more serious side of the new issue.
So this has actually just come out.
Mm-hmm.
On the website, but this with this investigation that took a year to do into a convicted fraudster called Martin Sargent, who worked as the Bishop of London's factotum, and then when he was thrown out, it was revealed concurrently that he'd stolen £5 million mm-hmm. from the Diocese of London. Convicted fraudster had stolen again, would you believe it? But at the same time, he'd created this burn book about all the other... He himself is gay, all the other gay vicars in the diocese, and made all these lurid and ridiculous allegations about that. This led to the untimely death of one vicar because mm-hmm. all these said allegations had to be investigated properly. And it explains really well how power works in the Church of England, because the Bishop of London has sort of monarchical powers of hire and fire, and it's not a ceremonial role at all. It's
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
it's one of real access to
mm-hmm.
millions, if not billions, of pounds. And you have the ability to upend your employees' lives in a way that you don't do in other sectors. So that was sort of the impactful type of journalism.
And that's 4 pages of long form text.
Yes, it's 3,500 words, mm-hmm. and with in the print version accompanied with 2 illustrations, full page.
And who did the illustrations in this case?
That's Paul Cox.
Paul Cox, uh-huh.
Who is also
who's a regular.
It's also my my fiance's father. Should I?
Okay.
We talk about nepotism in the magazine industry. Paul. I'm very, very lucky to work with Paul.
Best to be open.
Best.
But when you're carrying out investigations, you need to be transparent.
Yeah. Yes. Well, Paul was drawing for Vanity Fair and Telegraph and the Times when I was not even born. So uh-huh, I'm very, very uh-huh. lucky to have him.
Uh-huh.
Because that's that way round.
I think that explains very well the scope of the magazine. But for listeners, they might assume from what you're talking about that you know you've joined me here at the Mag Culture Shop, but you're going to go back to your office and there's going to be a kind of suite of different editors that are working in different rooms and a hubbub of activity. What is the setup at the Fence?
So it's just me working full time, and then there are five other members of the editorial team, some who are working 1 or 2 days a week and some who are working 1 or 2 days a month. And then Matthias Klotti does the art direction for the print magazine, and then Alex Christian does the design tasks for the social media.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a small team, but we've just had... A new editorial assistant join, working 1 or 2 days a month.
So it's growing.
It's growing, yeah.
That's good.
Slowly and sensibly.
And you mentioned the art direction there. And a vital part of the magazine is illustration. There's no photography.
No.
Which might surprise people, given the nature. I mean, for instance, the investigative story you just referred to. Obviously, there'll be pictures of the individuals concerned. Mm. You might show a photograph of the magnificent cathedral, but you go in the other direction. You duck away from that, and it's all very much black and white, hand-drawn illustrations,
yes.
Which is a key part of the identity. How did that come about?
Well, that I have to say, that was Mateus's inspiration. The art director's inspiration. And also purely for budgetary reasons, as I'm sure many of the listeners know, it's more expensive to print quality photography, whereas you can make extraordinarily beautiful illustrations and print them at a much lower cost. Mm-hmm. So there was a financial element to it too. We are going to have photography on the website at some point this year for the longer investigations to break them up.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. So we had these sort of quite ludic, fun illustrations that we have for the piece about St. Paul's. We don't have on the website, but within the magazine to continue the narrative of playfulness, you have these sort of slightly fun illustrations of an overweight Martin Sargent with loads of money.
And the cathedral is in the background, yes, and money is sort of falling out of his pockets, yes, and cases and stuff. Yes. So there's a sense that you can kind of embellish, emphasise elements of the story and make it more kind of cartoonish.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There is a comic element to the story in some ways. With online, it's good to. I mean, it's sort of similar to the New Yorker. They don't use illustrations for their longer, more serious pieces. And I think we might use some sort of. We will use some form of photography in the future for our longer pieces to break it up.
Uh-huh.
But it's still going to the print magazine, and will always be only illustrations. Uh-huh. I think that's.
And what's the process for that? For instance, the story about St. Paul's comes in. Is it you that contacts the illustrator? Do you think, oh, Paul Cox would be brilliant to illustrate this? Or
So it's split up section by section.
Mm-hmm.
So in this issue, we have. We had Mathieu Cosset, who's a French illustrator and set designer, doing the cover. And then he has the opening section here.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, in the fact section, which is the investigations at the beginning, this is Mickey Lowe, who's...
Uh-huh. An illustrator gets a section each issue.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So Mateus and I debate about how to split them up. This is actually a very good piece. This is... By Hanif Qureshi, the novelist, who's recently become paraplegic. His son has written about looking after him. It's a really lovely bit, and there's lovely illustration of 90s Shepherd's Bush. And so then it's done section by section. Again, there's some nice mosquitoes here by Mickey, Paul and Pressburger. And then in the feature section, Paul did the features this time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had... In the fiction, Mature again, and then at the back, we had Natalia Lobanova do the etc., which is the comic bits, the funnies.
That's. I'm really glad you clarified that. I hadn't caught the fact that they were done by sections, but that provides a really nice identity across the piece. So you're not just seeing one or two illustrations.
Exactly.
You see several in the same style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also, there's also nice for an illustrator where. There's some we're going to have to be more prescriptive with in terms of what we want. And then most of the time we're with some element of carte blanche. And Mickey, Paul and Natalia have all worked on the fence a few times. So they're familiar with the tone and the style. And it's a really nice thing to use the same group of illustrators again, occasionally Mateus will suggest a new person we can have, and but it's hard to sort of just have one person do one to begin with. We want them to have the range and the ability to do a whole section.
Does it always proceed smoothly? I mean, do you commission stuff and then take what you're given, or are you back at them saying, actually, could we have it a bit more this or a bit more that?
Oh, yeah, yes. No, Mateus and his assistant, Valerian, are both brilliant. There's certainly a bit of back and forth, but not a huge amount. And it's, we're a relatively small operation working with extremely talented people and we don't want to sort of throw our weight around. We want to collaborate, collaborate in a considerate manner. But yes, some of them took a few times. This is Nikki Haslam's. It's very hard to explain what this is without saying it. Nikki Haslam's Clarimandical Tea Time Hexagram. So we have our backspread, which is usually the pièce de résistance for the design section. I feel like the illustrations in this issue, they're always excellent, but this time they're the best they've ever been. Fantastic.
And I'd like to finish with just considering who reads the magazine. I always think of it as, well, I think you already mentioned, it is very London orientated, but certainly the humour and the UK's only magazine is a very kind of English sense of humour. So I would assume that most of the readers are in this country.
Two of my colleagues, Ray Sheen and Seamus, are Irish. So mm-hmm. we do have a good Irish readership. We also have, I think, something like 7% of our subscribers are in the States, mm-hmm. which is, we never publish anything about the States. Which I'm very pleased with, because a lot of our influences, Spy magazine specifically, and New York magazine currently, are great influences of mine. So that's a matter of some satisfaction. But yeah, I think the postcode with the most subscribers is SE5, and I think closely followed by E9 and N1. So. But I really like it when I see all the sales notifications go to my phone, and I can see somebody from Towcester or Huddersfield has just bought a subscription. And there are lots of people across all ages and throughout the country who really enjoy it, and that's really lovely to see.
Cool. Charles, thank you very much for coming in and talking about The Fence.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
That's it for another episode. Thanks to Cathy Olmedelis and Charles Baker for joining us, to Park Communications for their support of the podcast, and of course, thank you to you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a review wherever you're listening. And if you want to know more about what we're up to at Mag Culture, visit magculture.com and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Until next time.